There's a rumour that Wham's Last Christmas may make it to number one this year, and it's nearly a year on Christmas Day that George Michael died at his home alone. Today I'm with top celebrity biographer Sean Smith, who spent the last year with George, well, not really with George, but with his family, his friends, and even his neighbours, to find out who the real George is. He's written a book called George, out now. So hi, Sean. Welcome back to Radio Gorgeous.
Hello, Josephine. Glad to be here.
Well, it's Man Week, so you're allowed on. You know, it's very good timing, this book coming out.
Yes, I was on last year for Man Week. Exactly. And yes, it's a very good thing.
Yeah. So George Michael was one of the UK's biggest pop stars of all time. That's a quote from the book. Can you tell us more about the man? How did it all begin, his story?
Well, it sort of began in humble circumstances in North London. His dad was from Cyprus. He was a Greek Cypriot, and he came over here, as many did, in the 1950s to seek his fame and fortune. But he spent the first few years chasing young women and being a boy about town, and he was a waiter. But then he met George's mum, fell in love, and they got married and started a family, and needed to improve things for their family. And so through sheer hard work, his parents got them their first house in Burnt Oak, and then they moved, when George was a teenager, to Radlett. Now, what his father gave George that he had all his life was the ability to work hard and the determination to succeed. And those are very good ingredients to pass on to your children. And George always appreciated that. He didn't always get on with his dad, but he was very appreciative of the efforts that his father made. His mum, he really got so much from his mother. Strangely, she didn't care about money, although, you know, it's always easy to say that when you have plenty of it. But when they started as a young couple, she would work in the local fish and chip shop and just to raise extra pennies. And then when his dad got the first restaurant in Edgware, his mother would work shifts there just to see her husband, really. But George would go round to school friends for his tea and that sort of thing. George had, in those early days, he was called Yorios. That's his real name. Yorios Paniatou is the name of George Michael. He wasn't George Michael until he was 18. He was known growing up as Yogi, which is his pet name, from his elder sisters and his family. And his neighbours in Burnt Oak, which is near Kingsbury.
Where is that? North London?
Yeah, it's North London. Not far from the family restaurant in Edgware, which was called the Angus Pride.
And sounds like a steakhouse.
Yes, it does. It does. But it wasn't. It was a very, very popular and successful Greek restaurant. And his father was so successful that when they moved to Radlett, he had a Rolls Royce.
Wow.
You know,
wow, that's from immigrant waiter to Rolls Royce homeowner and restaurant owner is pretty impressive.
Yeah, I mean, George didn't see a lot of him growing up because he was always, you know, working. That was the ethic. And as I said, that's what George inherited from his dad. His mum's philosophy on life was always try and be nice to people, do as much as you can for them. The worst thing that you could do in the world is not to appreciate other people. And I think it's very interesting, since George died, how the world at large has realised what a generous-spirited man he was. In obviously all the charitable things that he supported, and he did it anonymously, because I think he took the view very early on, perhaps in a little bit to do with the world of Live Aid and Band Aid, that too many celebrities do it to be seen doing it.
Yeah.
And that wasn't for him. So he would do things on the understanding that it wasn't revealed that it was him who was bunging 50 grand into some project.
And he did that a lot. He also impulsively helped people as well.
Oh, yes. Yeah. He'd be watching TV. You know, he loved Richard and Judy. And they became friends of his. And if something took his fancy on that show, I think there was... Was there a student nurse on there or something who was trying to get money, and then he helped another couple with IVF, that sort of thing. But it's a long list of things that he saw and appreciated. His elder sister, Yoda, she ran a charity on his behalf, and she would sift through and filter requests, and they got many. And
what was the charity? What was the theme of it, sort of? You're not sure?
I'm not sure at the moment.
Okay. Well, it was obviously helping people in some way, yeah.
Yeah, shall I look that up?
Well, I'll go on to the next question, actually.
All right.
Yeah.
Okay,
So, he had an accident. No, can we just talk about when... Right, he had an accident, but before the accident, he was quite a different child. This is... I found this a very fascinating fact, because he actually loved nature, didn't he?
He loved nature. At the house in Burnt Oak, he had... There was a field out the back, and he would come in from primary school and whatever, and, you know, it was the days when children could go and kick a ball around in the field. But he was more interested in, you know, collecting bugs and beetles and all the sorts of things that mums really like their children to bring into the kitchen. So, and he was obsessed by that.
And he was quite an introspective little boy, wasn't he?
He was sensitive, yes. Yes, introspective to a certain extent. He was indulged because it's something that he was always aware of, that he had a more almost status, if you like, within the family as being the boy child of a Greek Cypriot family.
Exactly, Greek Cypriot. Yeah, the male. Yeah.
Yeah, he was the longed for youngest, and a male child. Yeah. So growing up, his sisters, he often said, had a more difficult time than he did, you know.
Well, the dad was probably strict about, you've got to come back, you've got to do this, you've got to work in the kitchen, you know.
Well, yes, indeed, or yeah. You know, no, you can't have a boyfriend type of thing.
God, it's unbelievable. Yeah.
But I don't think it was, you know, I don't think that was unusual. No. And I don't think it was, you know, especially oppressive. His sisters... loved their younger brother, and
so there wasn't any jealousy.
No, not at all, not at all. And they worked for him and with him throughout his life.
Wonderful. Didn't fall out with him. That's amazing.
I mean, Melanie, the middle sister, she is a talented hairdresser, and she used to do his hair. Mm. There's the wonderful story that when he was filming the video for Careless Whisper, that he didn't like his hair, and they were filming it in Florida, and they had to stop all the filming while Melanie got on a plane at Heathrow, flew to Miami to give him a haircut and sort his hair out.
Wow.
But then everything they filmed was then useless because there was no continuity because he had a different haircut. So they had to refilm it, and cost like another $75,000 or whatever it was to film this, which was a lot of money then, obviously.
But those were the days when a video was so important, wasn't it? It was the most, because it was early MTV years.
Early MTV years, the videos for George Michael songs were always very innovative and very watchable.
Did he have something to do with that?
Oh yes, yes. He was a perfectionist who liked to, you know, have a hand in everything that was going on in his life. So, right from an early stage, he took a very keen interest in everything to do with the business and concerning him. Something he got from his dad, and his dad helped him with. And he was very visual as well. The famous video of him and the supermodels from Freedom 90, wasn't it? You know, that cropped up when he was having dinner with his best friend, David Austin, and David's girlfriend at the time was a model booker. And they worked it out over dinner, and she fixed up all these models to go in. And, you know, he just decided that that was what he wanted to do for this video. He thought things through very carefully from A to Z.
Really interesting. Now, let's go back to this accident, because this was a kind of lightning moment, wasn't it?
Yes, he fell down some stairs at school. It's a story that he often told himself, because as being a sort of Damascus moment in his life, that after he'd had this fall, he lost all interest in bugs and insects, which was a great relief to his mother and his sister, and suddenly became obsessed by music. He didn't come from a musical family at all. There was no great music in the house. His dad used to play some what George thought was ghastly Greek music that he really had no time for, the sort of thing that you would hear in a Greek restaurant. And his mum and dad were great dancers, but they weren't musical in any way. They used to cut up a storm in the dance halls around North London when they were courting. But they didn't bring any great musical influence into the house. So really, it was what George heard on the radio and old singles that he found lying around. You know, his early sort of things that he listened to were the Supremes and Tom Jones from the time when Tom was really popular in the 60s, you know, It's Not Unusual type stuff, and Tamla Motown, and whatever was being played on the radio at the time, in the days when Radio 1 played the hit parade, really, if you want to call it that, and Alan Freeman and all these people were on the radio. So
Didn't he just pick up a violin or something?
Well, yes. He became very interested in music. And the musical instrument he chose was a violin, which later he mocked himself for playing the violin, but he was actually very good. I found this fascinating. I spoke to his old music teacher at his senior school, and who was lovely and really appreciated his talent at the time, and he was actually lead violinist in the school orchestra.
God.
Which I found remarkable. Yeah. This is George Michael. Now, they weren't playing, you know, Beethoven and Mozart and that sort of thing. What they would play, arrangements that she made of pop songs and popular songs.
Great, that's actually a good backing. That's actually good grounding for him, isn't it?
Because
he's learning to read music, he's learning about how a pop song's composed, you know.
Absolutely. I mean, he could read music teenage year. Very, very good. He had no problem with that whatsoever. He did music theory. And
yes, didn't he do music A-level?
He did music A-level for a year and then he gave it up.
But still, to get that far as music A-level, you know.
Yes. She said he was the best musician in the school. There was no question about that. But it's something that he sort of kept quiet in a rather modest...
Yes, because it was also a bit uncool.
Yeah, but he was always... I agree, it would have been thought of uncool. Mm. But he always had a very modest, self-deprecating air about him. I remember that the guy who engineered the first demos that his first band did, they were called The Executive, had no idea that George could even read music. And yet, you know, he was very accomplished, and he also was very good at picking things up.
So he was super talented then?
Oh, yes, he was extremely talented. Yeah. But he needed nurturing.
Mm-hmm. Now, what happened was that the family moved, because they made all this money, they moved to a kind of posher area, and they moved the family house... moved to the street where there was a kind of posh end and a lower end, but someone was living there who changed the course of his life, wasn't it?
Well, you're talking about Andrew Ridgeley, obviously. No, he didn't live in the same street. He went to the same school and he met George, who at the time was still Yorios, on the first day that George went to the school. This was in Bushy, and George's new home was in Radlett, which is a super affluent small town, really. Lovely.
Where is it?
Well, it's in Hertfordshire, just along the road from Bushy, really. I suppose it's on the way to Watford, where, you know, the boys would go to the cinema and that sort of thing. So on the first day, on George's first day, he was late going there because of the move from North London out of town. It didn't coincide with school terms and that sort of thing. So as teachers do, they said, can someone look after young Yorios? And to everyone's amazement, Andrew Ridgely, who, you know, never seemed to be involved in anything at the time, was rather a cool young man, put his hand up and said, I'll look after him, miss, give him to me. So they became best buddies. And Andrew Ridgely's importance in the George Michael story should not be underestimated. The press and the media are very guilty of that over the years, but he was very important in bringing...
Developing him.
Yeah, bringing him through at a time when he needed it. He was shy, and his first date with a girl was down to being, you know, pushed into it by Andrew.
Yes, because he wasn't confident of his looks, he wasn't physically confident because he'd been a bit plump as a child. I mean, you know, Andrew Ridgely had that supreme confidence, is what you need to be a pop star.
He had confidence. He also had great charisma as a as a teenager.
He was like the cocky lad, wasn't he?
Yeah, the girls loved Andrew. And the boys as well. You know, he was a very popular guy. You know, the guy you'd want to...
Everyone wants to be your best friend.
You know, the guy you'd like to go for a drink with. And, you know, he was good at football and that sort of thing. George always hated his hair. He had this great curly mop of hair that he never could control, which is why his sister did it for him from an early age. And he wore glasses and, you know, the usual teenage problems of spots and things, you know. But so he wasn't confident about the way he looked, but Andrew gave him confidence.
Yeah. Now, Andrew also, background was interesting. He was half Egyptian as well, wasn't he?
Yes.
He's alive.
Yes. Yes, indeed. His father was from Egypt, Alexandria, I think, and was very well brought up, intelligent, very liked in the local community in and around Bushy. Both his parents were. His mum was a teacher. I think. Well, she.
So
she's
they're not the
now.
Kind of ladsy, suburban-y, you know, they're a bit more middle class than you think.
Oh yes, definitely. Yeah. I mean, George Michael. I mean, these terms are a little bit out of date now, but he moved from being working class to middle class by his teens, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
So both he and Andrew were middle class. And they had certain similarities, I suppose, in that they were both the sons of immigrant fathers.
Gives you something really in common. Now, they also love disco and soul music, and they used to go down in their teens, which I find interesting, down to the West End of London and go to nightclubs.
Yes, I mean, they always seemed older than they were. George was quite a big lad as a teenager, so he never had any problems, even at sort of 15 and 16, getting into places. So they used to practice dance moves in the house before they left, and later they used to take Shirley Holliman as well, who was obviously the blonde singer in Wham, and they used to go off to the nightclubs and try out these moves. And on one occasion, I can't remember which club it was, but one of their favourite clubs, Andrew was just showing off, and he started going Wham Bam I'm the Man, and George was very good at picking things up, and he thought, oh, that's rather good. So he wrote a song entitled Wham Rap, based around Wham Bam I Am the Man, which Andrew was just clowning around on the dance floor.
Yeah, yeah. So they had formed a band by then, hadn't they? Can you tell us about that?
Yes, they Andrew was always badgering George because he realised, you know, that George was a talented boy. That they should, you know, make their fortune, and if they weren't going to be footballers, let's be pop stars. So George was more cautious about it because of his parental ambitions for him, and he wanted to stay on at school, which he did, and finish his A-levels. Andrew, meanwhile, had gone to sixth form college and was having the life of Riley, as, you know, he's entitled to do, age 17 or whatever. And eventually, though, he persuaded George that they'd start a band, and they sort of almost booked their first gig before they got the people involved, but they got other people from Bushmead School, which was their high school, to join them. Yeah, this was called The Executive. Yeah. They actually wrote a song called The Executive because they liked ska music at the time, and their favourite were The Specials and Madness. And Madness, of course, had a song called, I won't sing it, had a song called Madness. Yeah. So it was quite trendy to call yourself after the name of a song, which, of course, they also did with Wham! Rap. Yeah. So that was the thinking. And so there was a couple of guitarists and a bassist, and Andrew's younger brother, Paul, was the drummer.
And who are the singers then?
Well, Andrew, this is one thing I found fascinating, that at the time, Andrew was thought of as the equal singer with George. In fact, I spoke to one of the guitarists who said he always thought Andrew had a better voice, which, you know, now we're thinking, hang on, George Michael's got the best voice of all time. But
he hadn't found his voice, obviously.
Yes, he...
He kind of grew in the public eye, didn't he, really?
Yes, absolutely. And he also, being so musically accomplished, he was able to find everything to the right key and pitch and production that suited him throughout his recording career, so that when he established how he sounded good, that took him to another level.
Yeah. Now, obviously, Wham came a pop stars. They did really well. They were in that fantastic early 80s scene where it was Boy George. Just London was the place in the early 80s for music, especially pop music, which they were making. And then they became best-selling all over the world due to their amazing videos and songs, like you said. How did he then become a solo singer? How did that happen?
I think he always saw himself as a solo singer.
Oh, wow.
I mean, he wrote Careless Whisper when he was 17 on the bus, where he was working at a restaurant in Northwood, North London. So he used to get a bus from Radlett down to work in the restaurant as a DJ. And he wrote the song about the breakup of his relationship with his second girlfriend at school, who was he had two girlfriends at school, and I found that very, very interesting, because obviously in later life George became a gay icon. But Careless Whisper was actually written about a girlfriend, and he played it to her because they remained on good terms, and she had no idea it was about her.
Oh, that's really lovely.
Not until much later.
Yeah,
she just thought, wow, what a great song. And it was always a great song. But it's also a very interesting insight into the character of George Michael, because he played around with the song for several years before it was released. He recorded it several times. I spoke earlier about the video needed to be recorded, and then it was re-shot.
So was he a perfectionist?
No, he was a total perfectionist. I remember that his well-known producer, who did a lot of things with him in the early years, was asked once why they stopped working together. He said, "I was so bored. George took so long to do everything." So he would spend days or weeks on one song, whereas, you know, most artists just go in and bang, it's done.
Because you just touched on him being gay and his personal life, and I think that's really was the hardest thing in his life, relationships, wasn't it? It's where he had most drama and kind of ups and downs.
Well, I suppose that's true, but I think that's probably true of most people. I think the media and the... It's fine.
Keep talking, because it's recording
I think,
going out today.
Oh, right.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think most people have that in their lives, and I think that the media and the press over the years focused on that, because we have to remember that when George was first aware of his sexuality, that he was living in a time when everybody was frightened of AIDS, and he, you know, he didn't want to tell his mum because he was worried that she would worry and be frightened to death, as it were, about his social life and what he was doing and that sort of thing, because there were so many scare stories, because people still didn't understand the condition and what it was all about. These were times when, looking back on it, to be gay was almost sort of thought of as an affliction in some way, or even a handicap. Mm. I mean, incredible as it may seem today, in 2017, but we're going back to the early 80s.
Just think of all the gay people out there that just didn't come out. Freddie Mercury, Elton John...
well, indeed, and it's still incredibly...
Boy George didn't even come out.
Well, yes, yeah. I don't think that was a secret, though.
I know, but no, because lots of people, it didn't cross their mind.
No. Indeed, yeah, indeed. Yeah. So it was not something to, and also it wasn't something commercially to shout from the rooftops. Mm. I think that's a sort of grey area where George is concerned. It's sort of when you have started out on a path, it's rather difficult to change that path dramatically in the eyes of your fans and your public. He came out, for want of a better description, to Andrew and Shirley when he was 19, and they were filming a video in Ibiza. And they thought that it was a stage he was going through and advised him not to tell his parents. The older George, I'm sure, wished that he had been open with them, his mum and dad, at that point, and his whole life would probably have been different. As it was, he was always, even though it was not a secret that George Michael was gay, he was never out to the wider world for many years, until, of course, the notorious incident in the park in Beverly Hills. So that, I think that was a shame for him in many ways, because... you know, who would not want to reveal your real self?
But I can also see the problem with having this Greek dad who's a very strong personality.
Yes, indeed. And Andrew and Shirley advised him very strongly not to tell his dad. Mm-hmm. And also, I remember speaking to one of his girlfriends, who said to me that she wasn't aware that homosexuality existed when she was at school. And this is, you know, not so long ago. She didn't have friends who were openly gay. But of course, subsequently, you discover that they were and that sort of thing. So it was a very different age that George Michael grew up in. And he always felt that he didn't need to be defined, or didn't want to be defined, by his sexuality. He was a person, as it were, and that should not be something that defines him. It should be part of him, part of who he is. Mm. And why should he announce to some, you know, reporter he barely knows... about his sexuality.
It's a very intelligent view, isn't it?
Well, that's... Mm. I'm so pleased you spotted that about George's intelligence, because he... You know, I've written about a lot of people, and he is very... was a very articulate, intelligent man. And a lot of that was down to his mother. I remember one of his girlfriends said to me that his mother always treated him as a teenager as if he had interesting things to say... So he did. Mm. And I thought that was very interesting.
Yeah, gave him respect. Now, as you say, George is extraordinarily famous. He became extraordinarily famous internationally, you know, performed of Elton John, all his idols. We haven't talked about his total music taste, but he loved, especially kind of solo artists. It probably was his inspiration. He performed at Live Aid, all those different gigs, and yeah, famous in America. How did he handle fame? Because it's a massive thing to handle.
Well, obviously he longed for fame when he started, as Andrew did, because that's
the goal, isn't
that's
it?
That's yeah. the goal. But when you achieve the sort of fame that he achieved, it then becomes rather frightening, because it takes you over your world, and he didn't like that at all.
He is a private person.
Yes, that's true. He was a private person, but I think to get it in perspective, in the 1980s, George Michael was the most successful British artist in the world, and one of the top three artists in the world, and that was Michael Jackson, Madonna, and George Michael. And it's extraordinary to remember that. In the 80s, George Michael, for instance, was a much bigger star than Elton John. But Elton, obviously, is, you know, one of the all-time greats and has this wonderful catalogue of work. But you could not be a bigger star than George Michael in the 80s. And he hated it. He didn't like touring. One of the reasons he didn't like touring was that, to the world, he was still this sort of sex symbol, and to girls all around the world. And so after the concert in God knows where, he would go back to his hotel room and be alone. And you can be the most famous man in the world, but you're still alone.
Wow, really interesting. How did George relax then, off stage or out of the public eye?
He's always watched a lot of television.
He liked kind of early reality. Well, he liked those interview programmes, like you say, Richard and Judy. He liked daytime telly, actually.
He definitely did that. That's typical of somebody who stays up late. Yeah. They get up and they switch on and it's Jeremy Kyle or whatever. So yes, certainly. Early on, when he was growing up, they used to watch Parkinson, and that used to be a treat that he could stay up for. And later appeared on Parky's show several times, and he loved EastEnders, and he loved Coronation Street. That was probably his favourite, certainly growing up. Mm-hmm. So he just liked the things that we all like. We, you know, get in from work and turn the telly on, and it's Corrie. You know, who doesn't like that? So from that point of view, his tastes were very of the people. And he wasn't poring over Proust in his spare time or anything like that.
No, exactly. George kept being caught in public doing sort of things wrong, and he did end up in jail. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, I mean, you know, he had some various incidents connected with cars and being under the influence over the years. He always denied that he wasn't in control of his drug habit. It was never a secret that he, you know, smoked a lot of dope, etc. He was not shy about talking about it and that sort of thing. But it's not the best idea to drive under those circumstances, although there's some doubt about in some of his accidents whether he was under the influence or not. Eventually he had an accident where, you know, it was just one too many, and he got sentenced to, I can't remember how many months now, but
it was 8 weeks.
8 weeks, was it? Mm. He had 8 weeks. And
he did 28 days.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, well done.
Yeah. I've read it more recently than you.
Okay. Well, it's in the book. Yeah. Yes. And
still, that's quite a shocking thing to go
I think
from,
it's amazing to think that George Michael was in jail.
Yes.
He really shouldn't have gone to jail. I mean, you know, this is a totally different conversation about stupid sentences where people who shouldn't go to jail are sent to jail. He but clearly they, needed yeah. help, and yes. he didn't need jail time.
Yeah. Do you think he was only on dope? I mean, on marijuana, or do you think he was on harder drugs?
I I honestly don't know. I don't think it especially matters. I certainly think he smoked a lot of dope, and I don't think that's a secret. He would often just sort of chain smoke through the day, and various painkiller type drugs, I'm sure, were on the agenda. But whether harder drugs were ever taken, I actually don't know. And I don't really think it matters, because I think we're all aware that it's not a secret that George Michael had a drug problem that did not serve him well.
Yes, and it also, the last year of his life, he was in a clinic in Switzerland.
Yes, that's right. Costing an arm and a leg.
But he could afford it.
Yes, he was one of the lucky ones who could afford it. Whether it did him any good or not, I don't know. But he certainly became more solitary, more in isolation during those days. And when he got back, he spent much more time at his home.
I suppose he didn't want to be tempted, did he?
Indeed, that's absolutely right. So he spent more time at the village in Oxfordshire in his last year or two. He was making plans to do. I hate using the word comeback. It's so corny, isn't it?
Yes, he's not a comeback artist. He's too big for that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean,
another album, I suppose.
In later years, I loved his performance with the guy Joe, wasn't it, who won X Factor?
And they
sang "Don't Let the Sun Go Down on Me" together, and the look of excitement on Joe's face when he said, I can't believe I'm saying this, it's George Michael, and George Michael came out looking fabulous, and just held the stage because he still had it. And then he sang at the Olympics, didn't he? And he did a song there called White Light, which I think is a really underestimated song, probably his last great song. And it was about the time he had a near-death experience when he almost died in Vienna from pneumonia while he was on tour in the Sinfonica tour.
And that was about 3 years before he died, was it?
No.
Longer.
I can't remember the exact date.
Yeah.
Sorry.
But around 50. He was around 50.
Yeah, that's right. And you remember when he came out from his house in Highgate to talk to the media, and, he clearly was shaken by what had happened to him.
So that means he did die then, if he's talking about white light.
Yes, well, indeed. He had that near, however you want to describe it, that near-death experience. I think that's a great song. It's not a ballad. It's not a torch song in any shape or form. It's an up-tempo song. But it's one that I've listened to a lot in the last year. And
looking for answers, maybe.
Well,
in the song.
Yes, indeed. Mm. Or
inside.
He was always inspired by what happened to him.
Yes, he used his life, didn't he?
He did. Yeah. A Different Corner, for instance, that fabulous song from the 1980s is about a relationship he had. And we all know about Outside from the, where the lovely, amazing video where he dressed up as a policeman. So
that's a sense of humour, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Yes. But I love the way that he fought back. He didn't really have to... I mean, maybe fight's the wrong word, but...
He could have easily just said, forget that, but he literally had fun with it, didn't he?
Yes,
he said, I'm going to take the mickey out of you lot now.
Yes. Yeah. He refused it to be defined by that and curl up in a ball and apologise for who he was. And good for him, basically. And I always liked the reaction of his dad when he told his dad what had happened to him, that he'd been arrested for indecency in Los Angeles. And, it would probably, be on the news and everything. And his dad said the immortal phrase... just tell them to F off.
So that's what he did.
Yes, and that's what he did. And great for, good for his dad, basically.
So what's your personal take on Yorgos George after spending a year with him?
Well, one of the greatest artists of all time, but one of the things my main thread through the book is that George Michael was two people. That he was the great artist that we know as George Michael, who's left us a legacy of all these wonderful songs and was the most marvellous singer. And he was also Yorgos Paniatou, a private man, a kind man, generous-spirited, who wanted to live his life as he wanted to live it and follow the philosophy of his mother, you know, try and be as kind as you can be to other people.
Wonderful. George is published by HarperCollins and is written by Sean Smith. Thank you so much for coming on to Radio Gorgeous.
It's been a great pleasure, Josephine. Thank you.
For even more amazing women and men this week, go to radiogorgeous.com.